I'm David Liberty.
And I'm Eugene Johnson. And this is
Mataku Eoyasin.
Indeed.
For all you non-Indian speakers, that means all our relations in English.
Anyway.
And it is a beautiful Thursday.
Yes,
we're glad to be here to share some music and some information. And I've got a really neat quote I want to give to everybody here later on today.
Sweet.
So, and we've got news of powwows and other events, distant events. So,
I'll be
thanks for listening.
I'll be playing an interview I did with Jules Archer, 91-year-old man who is the author of The Plot to Seize the White House, which came out in 1973. You can only currently get it if you have like hundreds of dollars. I kid you not, because it is not in reprint. He's trying to get it reprinted. It's a very, very important piece of history. Something everybody should read.
You read it?
Twice.
Oh.
Checked it out from the library.
All right. Way to go.
Yeah. So we'll be playing that later in the show.
Yeah. Looking forward to hearing that.
Yeah. And it's my first time doing a pre-recorded phone interview and editing it. So I apologize ahead of time.
Please
for
be patient.
Technical
with
errors. Please.
He's moving from amateur to professional. So
woo-hoo!
We need to be patient.
It's only taken me, what, 13 years, I think?
Something like that.
But, anyways, this is the usual song we start out with lately, New Ways of Looking at Power. And this song I send specifically out to Suzanne Swift, who is currently held prisoner, basically, by the U.S. military. So, here we go.
Realize that women who are involved in the political struggle also have a struggle to face against you, because very often you haven't realized that there are many levels of the struggle. The struggle starts with yourselves, and the struggle starts with all of us. And part of the thing that we're always facing is trying to understand how to liberate ourselves within the context of a racist, misogynist society. And while we can feel a lot of solidarity with all of our brothers of color, the misogyny is perpetuated by you just as well as it is by the racist society.
Slavery is like going into the armed forces, if you like. The whole initial objective was to break us as people, so that we would accept whatever was going for us. And we managed to hold on to some things, and we're very proud of those things. I think that had we not become malleable, we would not have been able to survive on this continent. So that's the upside. The downside is, though, that part of that malleability was our conforming to the Moors and the points of view and the hierarchical concerns and the social structures of our masters, of the people who owned us. And the end result, in my view, is that we have adopted much more of their philosophy than we are required to. You can't live with masters without becoming like them. And We have to ferret out that portion of being like the masters that we are not happy with and not comfortable with and see as detrimental to us as a community and move to change those things. And it will not be easy, but it certainly seems to me it's probably worth the effort.
What makes it really terrifying is that with all this focus on the power of white men that men of color have, there is an obsession to get that power, that white male power. With all that focus, what happens when and if they get that power? What happens to the women? It's not going to be a pretty picture. So what needs to happen is there needs to be new ways of looking at power, rather than just focusing on white male power.
Uno de los peligros más graves para las mujeres de color yace en el hecho de ver a nuestros hombres frustrados con el poder blanco dominante, tomando represalias contra nosotras, así sometiéndonos al más bajo escalón en la escala de dominación. El asunto debe ser enfocado comprender y rebelarse contra la forma en general toma el poder establecido y rebelarse contra estas formas de dominación.
And that was Dancing on John Wayne's Head by The Fire This Time. And I'm not sure if you can still get that CD or not, but if you want it, there's a name of it. And I want to dedicate this next song coming up to all the rapists in the United States military who not only rape the alleged enemy women, but rape American women as well. As well as to all the priests out there and religious hierarchy that rape children. And anything to say before we get into this, David?
that's a good one. Tough to follow, yeah. Eugene.
This goes out also in support of Suzanne Swift, who alleges sexual harassment, sexual abuse in the military while she's over in Iraq. Not from Iraqi people, but from her fellow military people. And so, here we go. 7-year bitch. Dead men don't rape. want to know something?
What?
They don't. So, how have things been going, David?
Really good, Eugene. I was reading a fascinating issue of Oregon Humanities recently. This is a publication that comes from the Oregon Council for the Humanities here in Oregon. I was a former council member. Mm-hmm. And they did an article on the land, and they asked for people to contribute to this issue. And Kathleen Dean Moore, a professor at Oregon State, a very well-known professor at Oregon State, had a quote in here from Jack Forbes. You know Jack Forbes? He's a professor down at Berkeley.
Uh-huh.
He is Powhatan Renpe. And he had a really neat thing to say, because all through her article, she talks about how we are destroying our habitat, but we don't consider that when we destroy our habitat, we are destroying ourselves. But Jack Forbes put it very well when he said, "You can cut off my hands, and I will still live. You can cut off my eyes, and I will still live. Or you can cut off my ears, I'm sorry. Gouge out my eyes, I will live. Cut off my legs, my hair, my nose, I will still live. But if you cut off my air, I will die. If you take away the water, I will die. So why do you think that my hands and my eyes are more a part of me than the water and the air?"
Wow, that's really amazing.
It's a good way to put it. It's
yes,
brilliant.
It is. That makes me think of the book I'm currently reading, too, which is Reclaiming the Sacred by Winona LaDuke. And she talks about water issues, land issues, air, all from an indigenous perspective and from the indigenous fight to get those things back, as well as cultural items like that stolen by the Smithsonian and various mm-hmm. sick and twisted American collectors that think mm-hmm. the bones and relics of our ancestors are something to be collected.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway.
But it was really neat to see that Kathleen she's catching on. She is a oceanography uh-huh. professor, and she's member of really some major committees nationally and worldwide. She's well-respected around the world. So it's just an indication that there are people out there who are getting it, and yeah. she expresses it well.
Sweet.
But those words from Jack Forbes really cut through me more than anything she had to say, because people don't realize that connection, that if we didn't have the air to breathe, we couldn't live. You can live without your limbs, but you can't live without air. You can't live without water.
Yep.
And so everything you do to the air and the water, you're doing to yourself. People just don't realize that. So we are destroying our habitat, and we think that we can just go on blissfully living the same lives we used to live all these years, but it's not going to go on like that. It can't remain possible the way we're destroying our habitat worldwide.
Yep. Insane.
So people need to remember that they're connected to the air, and they're connected to the water as much as they are connected to their limbs.
An insane world.
Yeah.
So do what you can, folks. You can. Don't think the odds are overwhelming. You have the power. It is all within all of you. And it is possible to stop this monster. Otherwise, I wouldn't be here. David wouldn't be here. And you wouldn't be here. So do what you can, because you can. And you know you can.
Yeah, every action you take is going to have an impact on your environment.
Indeed it is.
So you need to consider every action. When recycling first began in Corvallis, it made me more aware every time I reached towards the garbage can with something in my hand, I hesitated. For years, I had never done that. I would automatically throw something in the garbage. And then it got me into the habit of, you know, this isn't garbage just because I used to think it was. Now we have better things to do with the stuff we use than throwing it away. Which is really, there is no such thing as a way. It's going to remain right here on Earth with us as yep. long as we're here, as long as the garbage that we make is here. It's not
our
going
neighbor.
Anywhere. Yeah, it's not. There is no place that you can throw anything away.
Like the thousands and thousands and thousands, well, probably millions, actually, of water bottles, plastic water bottles that people pick up at the store that they drink and throw into either recycling or away.
And the little tiny balls of foam that come from styrofoam when it breaks up into its smallest particle, those are found all over the world now in every habitat and in animal stomachs, and we will never be able to get rid of them. They'll always be here. The styrofoam balls have like a 50,000-year life or something. They're almost as bad as nuclear waste.
Yeah. Yep.
Depleted uranium.
Yes, indeed.
Yeah, just to remind everybody out there.
Yep.
It's the U.S. government is putting depleted uranium in our habitat.
Yep.
They are destroying our habitat.
And because of depleted uranium, I have heard recently that you're taking a big chance if you buy Army surplus now.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, because it may have...
It's been exposed.
Yeah. Been exposed to depleted uranium.
And maybe
good
not,
chances.
Yeah, good chance. Maybe not necessarily, but you never know.
Yep.
The stuff that's gone through their surplus, it could have come from anywhere.
Yes, it could have. And speaking of that, also, I watched this great documentary called Radio Bikini.
Mm.
And it's about the...
Bikini Atoll?
Yep.
The nuclear tests out there?
Yeah, the two of them that they did in 1946.
Yeah, The people were trying to go back. The natives were trying to get that island back.
Yeah, they still haven't, as far as I know. This documentary came out in 88, I think it was.
Well, it's so damaged. I mean, it may be able to support some life, but all the radiation that's there, I can't imagine it would be good for any human beings to be in there.
No, but check this out. Check this out. After the first test, within 24 hours, they had... naval ships in at ground zero.
Oh, yeah.
And mind you, they knew that the effects of radiation could kill a person with long-term horrific health effects. They already knew this, knew it for a fact. So they willingly and knowingly sent U.S. servicemen...
Guinea pigs.
The troops that were supposed to support, that the government, same government that sent them in there like this, that says we're supposed to support our troops while they're doing this horrific crap to them.
Yeah, some support.
Yep. They've suffered horrific, horrific cancer rates. And they were showing Geiger counters going, these guys would strip down. They'd be completely naked. They'd go out with their hands. Geiger counters would just be going, peaking. From their hands, peeking from their genital area, peeking. And they were being told that this would have no adverse health effects upon their lives.
What? You mean the U.S. government lied to their soldiers?
Yeah.
Huh.
So you want to join the military? You just might become part of a medical test you have no idea about.
Well, maybe right now they're doing depleted uranium experiments to find
it's
out
possible.
The effects on soldiers of depleted uranium. So.
Yeah. The one sailor that they were talking to, I forget his name. I should have memorized his name. I should have wrote it down. But the one soldier they were talking to, the one naval person that they were talking to, was talking and doing the interview as far as, like, you find out about how they didn't tell anybody about the health effects and so on. And they start panning out. And you see his left hand, and his left hand, it's about 10 inches across. I kid you not. It's swollen. It's so horribly swollen that it looks like something out of a Flintstones show, you know, when they smash your thumbs or whatever.
Oh, yeah.
And he talked about, you noticed he has no legs, and his left leg, several years after having gone to Bikini Atoll and been at ground zero 10 hours after the second bomb, as well as being at ground zero 24 hours after the first one, his leg started swelling so horrifically that they had to take his left leg off. A couple of years later, his right leg started swelling horrifically, so bad that it split from the back of his knee down to his heel. They had to take it off.
Oh, man.
And there he was sitting with his left hand in this wheelchair with this horrible, horrible swelling, and he died a few months after that interview. And so that's a documentary you need to watch. If you want to join the military, there is a chance, it's not saying you will be, but there is a good chance that you will be tested on in one form or another without your knowledge, without your consent.
Yeah, so take your chances if you want to join up.
Yep.
You could be faced with being a human guinea pig.
Yep, and if you're a woman, you could also be facing rape from your fellow servicemen.
Sexual harassment all the time, yeah.
Yep. And so you guys are taking a chance joining that horrible, horrific organization. You really are.
Well, I saw a documentary the other night, Eugene.
What's that?
Only it was a horror movie. It was called The Dark Side.
Ah.
And it was about our Vice President, Dick Cheney.
Indeed.
Who they were show how Dick Cheney would continue to maintain lies after they'd been proven false. clearly, in this documentary, it showed consistently how the evidence would show one thing. Cheney would say the exact opposite of what the evidence showed again and again and again, and that he would maintain these lies, tell them for over a period of years. I mean, and even today he's probably saying that, you know, we're going to find the weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. I'm sure they're out there. He's convinced that they've got weapons of mass destruction, despite all the evidence to the contrary. It was a scary movie. It was a horror show, I consider it, because... I had thought at one time that George Bush was the Antichrist. Now I'm convinced that it is Dick Cheney who is the Antichrist. It was scary. It was really, and he was, when I heard him being interviewed on Sean Hannity the other day, I just happened to catch the Sean Hannity show when I was driving home from work, and he was interviewing Dick Cheney. And Hannity just plays right into Cheney's hands and gives him these great leading questions. And it's just really disgusting how the whole right is.
Did you say Reich?
The Fourth Reich has taken over the media, especially Fox, and they're running the country against our will, against the better judgment of most of the Americans right now. And Cheney said he doesn't care what the polls say. He said that they were elected to do what they thought was best for the country, and that's what they're doing.
That's odd, because they weren't elected.
Doesn't matter if people, that's a whole nother story there. Yeah, they weren't elected. You know, if you read the Rolling Stone article that Robert Kennedy Jr. put out.
As well as Greg Palast.
And it's gotten some discussion in the mainstream media, but there's about only one guy in the mainstream media that ever gives any news that is newsworthy, and that is Keith Olbermann on MSNBC. He will actually criticize the government. I'm amazed he hasn't lost his job by now.
Or his life.
Yeah. But I like to watch the McNeil Lehrer show when I can, although... One of the hardest things about the McNeil Lehrer show is they do their roll call, honor roll of dead U.S. soldiers. And at first, you know, it was easy for me to watch. And the more I saw that roll call, the harder it gets every time to look at the faces of the dead soldiers and read their names. And their ages, especially, is the hardest part. And, you know, you want to apologize to these guys for what happened, but it's too late. They're dead.
Not to speak of the Iraqi and Afghani dead.
But at least somebody is giving them some attention, you know.
Yep.
I haven't seen, rarely have I seen any other media outlet tell us or show us their faces, where they're from, how old they were. And I thank PBS and the McNeil Lehrer Show for taking the time to put that little roll call together for us. As hard as it is to watch, it's very necessary.
Yep.
Because people are just separate. You know, we're not asked to make any concessions for the war, except maybe pay more for gasoline or something, make more profits for the corporations.
Yep, free money to already wealthy people.
But it's been so easy for most Americans. We haven't been asked to sacrifice, you know, to give up your tune foil or your steel or do things like have been asked of us in the past in major wars. So without a greater impact, it's easier for most Americans, U.S. citizens, to just forget that the war is happening. You know, they don't have to think about it if they don't want to.
It's only affecting us at the gas pump.
So, yeah, it's too bad that people haven't been asked to make more sacrifices for this war. In fact, quite the opposite when you look at all the tax cuts that the rich are getting and the profits of the corporations. This war has been very good for some people.
And many people out there are sacrificing their children. Their children are sacrificing their legs and arms, eyes.
Yeah. Yeah,
for
like 15,000 permanently disabled.
For the wealthy.
Yeah.
It's not for our freedom. I don't feel any freer.
No.
In fact, they're clamping down on our freedoms.
Oh, yeah, all the time.
And besides, this is an occupied territory. This is our land.
They know who you called, and they know who's calling you, and how often, and from where, and it's tough to hide today, folks.
But give it a shot. You know, what can you lose?
So we lost a soldier from Madras,
mm-hmm.
Private First Class Tucker. And his dad, Wes, who I want to give a shout out to, Wes Tucker,
one
of my new heroes, had a national forum to comment on what happened to his son. That guy just was so amazing that he would actually say the things he did. I don't have the paper in front of me, but the gist of it was that regarding the bad treatment, they know his eyes were gouged out, beheaded, or sliced up with a machete, or whatever it was that happened to him. And Wes Tucker said that the people over there are doing the same thing to us that we're doing to them. But he didn't see any difference in what we're doing to the Iraqis and the Afghanis and Taliban and Al-Qaeda. What we're doing to them, they are returning in kind. The same, what we're meting out to them, they are meting back out to us. I thought it was really brave of him to say that.
Yes, indeed.
And a national theater. And Wes, way to go, brother.
I'm sorry to hear of your loss.
Sorry to hear, but thank you for speaking from the heart and speaking the truth.
Indeed. And it's 2 o'clock. You are listening to KBOO 90.7 FM here in the great city of Portland. And also, as I was playing those songs for Suzanne Swift, Code Pinker called up and said that, I believe she said Tuesday, they're going up to Fort Lewis to stand with the sole solitary person that has been standing out there in front of Fort Lewis in support of Ouattara. But they're also going to be up there in support of Suzanne Swift as well. So
yeah, Lieutenant Ouattara, bless his heart, came out and said the war in Iraq is illegal and I'm not going to go fight it. Yeah, duh.
Right on.
How come more military haven't done the same thing? Well, it's probably because they're fear for their life or something.
Yep, they can
thrown in the brig for life or
like
treason or whatever.
Like Ouattara said this last weekend, it was this last weekend. He was here in town on Saturday. He said that you live in fear of not going along to get along because as that organization works, the military works, if you speak out or do anything else that throws a monkey wrench into the horrific system, your fellow military men can come after you. They'll mm-hmm. beat you, harass you.
Mm-hmm.
Even some of Watata's men were even threatening to frag him.
Yeah.
So, and if those of you who don't know what fragging is, that's when an enlisted man kills his officer.
Uh-huh.
And so...
Wow.
So
let's declare a code pink.
Woohoo!
We declare a code pink in Portland.
Code pink.
Okay. Well, I have a poem to read.
Huh.
Do you want to...
Yeah, all right.
Yeah.
Poem.
Just so you know, I'm going to try and get a song in a little later by Jim Pepper, as Sunday the 25th is the day we got one of them. the anniversary of the Lakota, Cheyenne, and Arapaho getting G.A. Custa. But this is not about G.A. Custa. This is called I'm Lucky to Be Alive, and I just wrote it today, so here goes. As I continue reading Winona LaDuke's book, Reclaiming the Sacred, I must admit, I feel lucky to be alive. I mean, America's attempt at genocide against us Indians. Holy! What the F? The depths of the genocide America has enacted upon the indigenous nations of this hemisphere is amazing and almost unfathomable as I read about how museum curators are reluctant to return things like the foot of a baby that was cut off as a trophy by a soldier at the Wounded Knee Massacre in order to get her moccasin. And her foot is still in it. Mummified, they say. It is a poem of the depths of the most brutal sorts, a poem of death, murder, and genocide that has created this nation like rape of women, destruction of the earth, genocides of other nations, lynching and enslaving blacks, brutalizing and slaughtering Chinese immigrants, and the list goes on and on. It's a poem, a red nigger baby's foot cut off as a trophy, kept in a museum by people who don't want to return their trophies, their red nigger baby's foot like a lucky rabbit's foot, like genocide, like a sweet scalp, like stripping Pawnee graves and stealing the clothes off of the carcasses of the deceased for sale, profit, and amusement. It's a poem like bullet-ridden cradle boards, also stolen from the Wounded Knee Massacre, like the skulls with bullet holes in them, housed in the Smithsonian University of Oregon Peabody Museum. All of them want to keep their trophies of the long gone, lost, red nigger race. Reminders, reminders, reminders of the dominance. Effing us up the A like dogs showing their dominance. Who's the boss? Who's the master? Say uncle. Effing uncle already! And I'm lucky to be alive. And Rhonda is lucky to be alive. And Felicia is lucky to be alive. And David is lucky to be alive. And Eli is lucky to be alive. And Clifford is lucky to be alive. And Trevino is lucky to be alive. And Mikkel is lucky to be alive. All of us red niggers are lucky to be alive. As we have faced and continue to face one of the most horrific genocides ever in its scope, intensity, and continuation. And I am here to tell you that I want it all back. And no, I will not treat you in the manner you have treated me or my people, because that behavior is absolutely reprehensible and, well, in my opinion, wrong. So don't start thinking about yourself, worrying about deportation and all that stupid BS you all so often do when I tell you to your face that I want it all back. Instead, think of that lucky baby's foot. That little red nigger lucky baby's foot, housed like a trophy, like a mistake made by your God, to be corrected, a problem to be solved. Think of her. She is a poem, a beautiful living being destroyed by America's like you, in order to create this great nation we allege it to be, a nation that by mere rule of force never has to pay for its crimes against humanity. Lucky red nigger baby's foot, trophy in a museum where lucky curators refuse to do what is right in order to keep their little trophy. Lucky red nigger baby's foot, mummified in her moccasin from the genocidal massacre field known as Wounded Knee. A poem. A poem about America. And I, like all the red nigger race, are lucky to be alive as we continue to possess our dead. As you would continue to possess our dead, like you would your dining room table, eat where you eat your potatoes, taste the corn that are grown, I'd like to say, on the dust of our bodies, but they are housed in museums and universities instead, like the Smithsonian and the University of Oregon, while the lone white man remains eternally alone on Memaloose Island, who wanted to be buried with the indigenous brethren, having lost faith in his own people, but they stole them from him, and now he is alone. Alone, alone, and I'm lucky to be alive. All of us indigenous are lucky to be alive. Lucky to be alive. lucky to be alive. And I want it all back.
Loan me a minute, let me borrow your ear. I'll sing you a song about Leonard Peltier. He's gone so long in a federal jail, the innocent victim of a tangled tale. In South Dakota, where the fear has grown, the presidents watch from a mountain of stone. They say all people are free to roam. There ain't no freedom in the Indian home. How many have gone before? And tell me how many more must be lost to the Indian war? The company spoke to the high command. We need the deeds to the Indian land to dig for oil and uranium ore. Maybe have to start a little Indian war. The orders came from away on high, and if it was a job for the FBI, it won't be hard. All we'll have to do is just cause a little trouble and follow it through. In Oglala, where the spirit did dwell, was a time they remember well. There were women and children gathered there when the wind blew a warning through the whispering air. And Leonard Peltier was one of those who came to the call when the time arose. And dangerous strangers were prowling around, bringing trouble to the reservation ground. That was when the agents made their play in a gunshot battle on a deadly day. And three men died in the hollow sand, two FBI and an Indian man. How many have gone before? And tell me how many more must be lost to the Indian war? Joe Stunts was a man that died that day, but the eyes of the law didn't see it that way. All they cared about was their own kind, gonna get somebody for a capital crime. The charge was set for homicide, but Leonard got away to the Canada side, where he lived for a while in the northern town, till they came up and got him and brought him back down. Judge and the jury, they both agreed, two times murder in the first degree. They pounded the gavel and they rang on the bell, two times life in a federal cell. Citations came from Washington, congratulations on a job well done. Two agents gone is a mighty price, but if you want something bad, you gotta sacrifice. And now Leonard Peltier is a captured man, with both legs taken so he cannot stand. One more swallowed by the master plan to get their hands on the Indian lands. How many have gone before? And tell me how many more must be lost to the Indian war?
So it's been since days of old, when Custer died for a mountain of gold. But times have changed and passed him by. He's been replaced with the FBI. Oh, it's all so easy to weep and moan for a warfare fought so far from home. You can preach of peace from a righteous stand, but there ain't no peace on the Indian land. When Joe Stumps was lowered down, the winds did blow with a mighty sound. The answer came in the driving rain. This man will not have died in vain. For the hollow power of the lock and key ain't nothing to the power of the raging sea. The lightning strikes in the angry skies that puts the power into people's eyes. Oh, the weather is building to a mighty storm, and the words in the wind that come to warn are once more spoken to your ear. Only this time the name is Leonard Peltier. How many have gone before? And tell me how many more must be lost to the Indian war?
That was Exile by Black Fire from their CD One Nation Under. And for those of you who do not know, Not Worth the Bullet is a quote from that well-known great American hero, Kit Carson.
Oh, that's because, who said that. Huh?
Yeah, when he was forced marching the Navajo to the reservation, the Diné, he stated, one of his soldiers asked, well, what do we do about the people who can't keep up? Well, Kit said, they're not worth the bullet. So they bash their heads in with the butts of their guns.
Hmm.
Great American heroes.
What a way to save money.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay,
speaking
here we are.
Of spending money, you know, the University of North Dakota, the Fighting Sioux, they were told by the NCAA that they could not use their name and mascot if they made it to any playoffs in any sports event. Well, the University of North Dakota has decided that they are going to fight the NCAA in court, that they insist that they should have a name that demeans other people, and that they're willing to go to court and spend tons of money to fight to demean Native American people.
But I'm not a racist.
Now, the Fighting Sioux, the name has been able to stay because one of the major benefactors who built this huge hockey ring said that if you don't keep the name, I'm going to stop funding this hockey ring construction.
Extortion.
So he was able to keep that going, but the NCAA took this action very admirably to try and stop people from using mascots that demean other people.
Racist.
And the Fighting Sioux decided that they're going to fight. Now people are calling them the University of North Dakota Fighting Lemmings because they're all jumping off a cliff together, as this writer Nick Coleman from the Star Tribune, who I got this information from. They are willing to continue to their racist name and image in spite of pressures from tribes and the NCAA and others who have fought this.
We are proud of our racism.
So
we will continue our racism because we have every right to be racists in this nation by having a racist name for a team, sports team.
So talk to the University of North Dakota Fighting Sioux there, folks, if you want to get a hold of them and say, hey.
I'm sure you can find them on the internet.
Why are you going to spend all this money just so you can be a racist organization? See what they say to that.
Well,
so
with that,
that was some news I wanted to give you guys out there.
Well, with that, since we'll do announcements after this next song then. What do you say?
All right.
So here we go.
Good.
Called beautiful ignores the religious freedom of the native people, steals water and other natural resources from the native people, dumps toxic waste onto the lands of the native people, pumps gin and whiskey juice into the homes of the native people, and fails to live up to over 400 treaties signed with the native people. But then, this country, America, the so-called beautiful, proclaims to honor the native people by naming sports teams after them. Teams like the Atlanta Braves, the Cleveland Indians, the Chicago Blackhawks, the Washington Redskins, the Kansas City Chiefs, the Florida State Seminoles, and the University of Illinois Fighting Illini. But that's not honoring. That's objectifying. That's caricaturizing. That's humiliating. That's stereotyping. That's degrading. That's exploiting. And that's the same as having teams like the San Francisco Sambos, the Jackson State Jungle Bunnies, the Seattle Spearchuckers, the New Orleans Niggers, the Detroit Darkies, the Cincinnati Coons, the San Diego Spicks, the Green Bay Greasers, the Baltimore Beaners, the Washington Wetbacks, the Chicago Chinks, the Golden State Gooks, the Kansas City Kikes, the St. Louis Semis, the New Jersey Jews, the New York Heinies, the Houston Honkies, the Oklahoma Opes, the UCLA Crackers, the Phoenix Rednecks, the Pittsburgh Peckerwoods, the Wichita White Trash, and the Brigham Young Blue-Eyed Devils. But that's not honoring, that's objectifying, that's caricaturizing, that's humiliating, that's stereotyping, that's degrading, that's exploiting, and that's why I would never buy a Jeep Cherokee. I said, that's why I would never buy a Jeep Cherokee. Never buy a Jeep Cherokee. Jeep Cherokee, never buy. Never buy. Never buy. Never buy.
That was D Knowledge from his CD, All That in a Bag of Words. That was Why I Will Never Buy a Jeep Cherokee.
And a good follow-up to the University of North Dakota news that I gave you guys a minute ago.
Absolutely.
But there is other news going on in and around the greater Oregon country.
Tell us.
This weekend is the annual Paiumsha powwow at Warm Springs Indian Reservation.
Woohoo!
And Paiumsha, for those of you who don't speak Indian, means a gathering place in Sahopton.
I thought it meant fry bread here.
Yeah, it could be interpreted that way. One of the neat things about Paiumsha is they have stick games going on almost 24 hours a day there.
Right on.
So
I've never been to a stick game.
If you want to do a little gambling on the side, you can get in on the stick game.
Oh, honey.
They're fun to watch.
I have a suggestion of something we could do this weekend.
Yeah, why don't you go to Warm Springs?
And play some stick game.
And reservation powwows are better than, relatively, I mean, in my opinion, I should say, yeah. Reservation powwows are better than urban powwows. And mainly just because there's a lot more participation and a lot more activity going on in and around the powwow grounds.
But how's the fry bread?
Choices. You get your choices of fry bread. You can go around and check for the best one.
So we need junior fry bread out there. wish we had that CD in town.
Yeah, we should have that somewhere, don't we? Arrogant Star?
We have Arrogant Star, but not the one with that particular song, unfortunately.
We'll have to get that.
Yes, indeed.
And the weekend following is the Wild Horse Powwow out at Mission, Oregon. Nechtiawe is the actual Indian name for that land, which means a good place. And that is the June 30th, 1st, 2nd, and 3rd of July, starting the weekend after Paiumsha. So if you're looking for another powwow on 4th of July weekend, go up to Pendleton, right next to
bread.
Wild Horse Casino. They got Betty's Fry Bread.
Betty's.
Ooh, Betty's.
I haven't had Betty's.
Betty Burke, she makes great fry bread.
Woohoo!
Really good. She is the master fry bread maker on the res.
Right. Oh, Betty's fry bread.
Betty's fry bread.
Take it out
that's
that way.
That's right.
Well, honey.
So that's what I had, Eugene.
Okay. I have
a
few items here. Northwest Progressive Community 2006 June Monthly General Meeting. Corporate Threats to Community Media and the Internet. How do you respond? The Senate has recently passed a bill, still has to go through the House, that will basically come close to, if not completely destroy, cable access television. Mm. So you can talk with Laura Etherton of Osberg and Rob Brading, Executive Director of Metro East Community Media. That will be this Sunday, the Death to Custer Day, 130 years, June 25th. 3:30 to 4 p.m. dessert potluck, 4 to 6 p.m. program. And that will be at the Community Room, People's Food Co-op, 3029 Southeast 21st. It's about a block north off of Powell on 21st.
Portland, Oregon. Attack on the last bastion of free speech in TV.
Indeed.
Yeah. the corporations can't control public access, so they just want to get rid of it.
Yeah, they must destroy.
Yeah.
That's what they like to do, you know.
Yeah.
Anyways, Payam Show. Oh, you already said that one.
Yeah.
Tune in to KBOO this Friday at 6 p.m. for Bread and Roses. Host Leanne Kranz welcomes Carrie Dan. Woohoo, Carrie. And Judy Fischel, the lawyer for the Western Shoshone Defense Project, as well as Deborah Whiteplume of Defend Bear Butte. And I'll be out there when Carter Camp hits up that camp on July 4th for a discussion about indigenous sovereignty, honoring treaty rights, and sacred places.
Boy, Carrie Dan's almost a local now.
Dang near. Heads up about an upcoming event in July. Naya Family Center will be holding Portland's first Native American housing to home ownership fair Saturday, July 29th. Don't forget about that, folks. Write that down on your calendar now. From 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. in the Mount Tabor Hall at Portland Community College Southeast Center.
NAYA being the Native American Youth
mm-hmm.
Association,
mm-hmm.
for those who don't know.
And the PSU Native American Student and Community Center is looking for a volunteer web designer to train the staff and to manage their website. Please contact Sarah Vandahai. At 503-725-9697 or sav@pdx.edu.
So you might be able to write that time off on your taxes, too, donation to a nonprofit or something.
Yeah. And Sherman Alexie, who is not here, will be speaking tonight at the
we
PCC.
We tried to get him.
Yeah, at the PCC Cascade campus, which is basically on the corner of Killingsworth and Albina. He's a Native American novelist, poet, screenplay writer. He's the one that wrote Smoke Signals and Business of Fancy Dancing, those movies, as well as wonderful books like the Tonto and Lone Ranger Fist Fight in Heaven. This will be at the PCC Cascade campus, 7 p.m. tonight at their gymnasium.
So there is a fee.
Yeah, it's a $10 fee.
$10.
To see somebody who would not come down to KBOO.
Yeah, so. we didn't tell him that we'd have a babysitter for his kids if he came by, so.
The bum.
Darn it.
Anyways, shout
maybe
out to
next
you,
time.
Sherman. Oh, and a shout out to you, too, Trevino. Ran into you yesterday, and we traded books.
All right.
It was good seeing you, Trevino.
Yeah.
Indigenous Ecuadorian activist Felix Shuma, I think is how you pronounce it. We'll talk about his people's culture, dance, traditional medicine, and music at the PSU Multicultural Center Thursday, June 29th, 7 to 9 p.m. He hopes to network with many Native North Americans. You can contact PDXFLOR, that's PDXFLOR, at yahoo.com for more information. And there's a couple of people who are going to possibly be going to prison for helping people who were Mexican immigrants who were crossing illegally. A couple of, I believe, nurses or doctors or a nurse and a doctor. I'm trying to read through this real quick. But anyways, they'll be talking at St. Andrew's Church this Saturday, June 24th. From 7 p.m. to whenever, which is St. Andrew's Church is at 806 Northeast Alberta. And that's Daniel and Shanti. And they face up to 15 years for not letting some illegal immigrants die in the desert. Mm-hmm. So you can go there and help out with that as well.
All right.
And so with that, I'm going to play a cart, and then I'm going to play a Jim Pepper song in honor of the killing of Custer. So, here we go.
The 14th Annual Good in the Neighborhood Multicultural Music and Food Festival beginning at 12 noon on Saturday and Sunday, June 24th and 25th. The event is located at King School Park at 4815 Northeast 7th Avenue, next to King Elementary School. The festival kicks off with an annual community parade at 11 a.m. on Saturday from the Emmanuel Hospital parking lot and features 2 days of fun, music, food, and festivals. The musical performers include Linda Hornbuckle Band, Patrick Lamb, Norman Sylvester Band, Andy Stokes, Ocean 503, and much more. For more information, log on to www.goodintheneighborhood.org or call 503-282-1288.
Romper Room. Today we're going to say hello to all our friends at the KABU Board of Directors, which is meeting this Saturday at 10 a.m. Let me take out my magic mirror to say hello to all the KABU Board of Directors. I see Mark. Oh, and look, there's Steve and Jane. And there's Orion and Jean. Oh, I see Cherie and Peter. And there's Judy. And who's that? It's Elsie and Zale. Thank you, Magic Mirror, for helping us all say hello to our friends on the KABU Board of Directors. And you can say hello to all of them, too, just by attending the KABU Board of Directors meeting this Saturday, June 25th at 10 a.m. Come to the meeting at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue this Saturday at 10. Okay, everybody, let's get out our beanbags. and toss.
Yeah.
Been a while since I've had a romper room reference. Okay.
I loved that one. That was one of my favorite cards ever. Good job, Robbie.
Yeah, way to go.
Okay, that said. Well, anyways, we're gonna close out with a song here and then go into the Jules Archer interview and hopefully get most of it in before the end of the show.
Yeah.
So we're going to say our goodbyes now.
Yes. Oh, so, it's so sad to go.
Yeah.
I miss you guys.
So, dang.
But we'll be back in 2 weeks.
Yes, well, you'll be back.
I'll be back in 2 weeks.
And I'll be on the phone.
And we'll get you on the phone.
From Cass Lake, Minnesota.
Find out what's going
Indigenous
on.
At the Environmental Network Conference.
That's right.
So, that's going to be awesome.
Yeah, that'll be cool. So,
absolutely. So, for those of you who do not know who Jules Archer is, like I stated previously, he wrote the book, The Plot to Seize the White House. It is a book everybody should read about the 1933 attempted fascist overthrow of the United States government by the American Liberty League, America's Wealthy. And so, before we go into that, I want to dedicate this next song to my honey, Jim Boyd, off of the CD Reservation Blues with Sherman Alexie.
Wait, Jim Boyd is your honey?
No, my honey is Rhonda. Hi, Rhonda. So this is Indian Boy Love Song, goes out to my honey Rhonda.
You walking with those dark legs of yours. I felt you walking through my sweat lodge doors. And don't you wonder when you're there in the dark, just hear the drummer beating time with your heart. I hear you talking about your trail of tears. If you feel the need, I can help calm all of your fears. I'll be here watching and I'll wait for your call. I'll catch you, sweetheart, when you feel you may fall. I wanna say hey, yeah, hey, yeah, hey, yeah, hey. Wanna say hey, yeah, hey, yeah, hey. And I wanna say hey. I wanna say hey, yeah, hey, yeah, hey, yeah, hey. I can see you playing game all night long. I can see you smiling while you're singing the song. I'll be here guessing which hand holds the bomb. I hope I choose right so I won't be alone. I wanna say hey, yeah, hey, yeah, hey, yeah, hey. Wanna say hey, yeah, hey, yeah, hey. And I wanna say hey, yeah, hey, yeah, hey, yeah, hey. Wanna say hey, yeah, hey, yeah, hey. And I wanna say hey, yeah, hey, yeah, hey, yeah, hey. Wanna say hey, yeah, hey, yeah, hey. And I wanna say hey, yeah, hey, yeah, hey, yeah, hey. Wanna say hey.
This is Eugene Johnson, and we're about to conduct an interview with Jules Archer, who is the author of many books, But the one book we're going to talk about in particular is his book, The Plot to Seize the White House. Hello, Jules. Are you there?
Yes, I am, Eugene.
Okay. Could you tell us what it was? The book was printed in 1973.
That's correct.
And it's no longer in print at the moment.
That's also correct.
But I was wondering if you could tell us what motivated you to write this particular book.
Well, at the time, there was a George Seldes, who is a famous journalist, a guy who specialized in telling the truth that the regular media ignored. He wrote, in fact, he mentioned this plot. It intrigued my curiosity. So I got in touch with the John McCormick, who was the Speaker of the House and was the head of the McCormick-Dickstein Committee investigating the plot. And I learned all the facts from McCormick.
And that was with the McCormick-Dickstein?
Yes, that's right.
Okay. And how long did it take you to write this particular book?
I can't remember at this date.
I guess it was a while ago.
For 28 books and so. I mean, pardon me, 85 books.
Wow.
So I can't remember how long it took me to write any one of them.
Now, half the book deals with a biography of Smedley Butler. Could you tell us some about Smedley?
Well, Butler was chosen as the target of the plotters. They wanted a man who would lead an army against Washington, and they originally wanted MacArthur, but MacArthur was in disfavor because he had chased the Bonner's army out of Washington, and he was unpopular with his soldiers, and they wouldn't follow him. So Butler, on the other hand, was very popular with not only the people in the army but the Navy and Marines as well. He would visit them in the hospital after the war, after World War One, and he would keep in touch with them. And they knew him as a man who would stand up for them, and they would follow him. So they decided, even they were reluctant because they felt that he was a communist or a socialist or something, and they were afraid to go with him. But the ringleader of the father convinced them that he was the best man for the job, so they went after him. And one of the things they tried to get him to do first was to argue in favor of the gold standard. Roosevelt was off the gold standard, and their claim was that if they wanted the bonus paid in worthwhile money, in gold certificates rather than paper money. And they wanted him to go to the American Legion and make a speech for the gold standard. And then they wanted him to round up an army of soldiers to lead a march on Washington.
And why did Roosevelt take us off the gold standard?
He wasn't interested either way, except he supported Roosevelt. And Roosevelt was against the gold standard.
Why?
He was against it because it would dislocate the economic system, have gold bases internationally as well as domestically. And so Butler didn't want to do this. And they tried to force him to go to the Legion, make the speech in favor of it. They tried to bribe him with money and with promises to pay his mortgage and other benefits if he would cooperate with them. The plotters were the American American Liberty League, which was composed of Wall Street tycoons and wealthy millionaires. And they were the ones who were behind the plot to seize the White House. Their plan was to seize the White House and take Roosevelt a prisoner, claiming that he needed help because he was in a wheelchair, and they would provide him with an assistant president who really run the country. What it was, in fact, was fascism. They wanted to turn America into fascist. And they sent their key man, a man named McGuire, to Europe to study how it could best be done. And first they thought it would be in the imitation of Mussolini and Hitler. But he went over there and he didn't think that they Americans would follow a leader in that vein. So he did have a find in France an organization called the Croix de Feu, Cross of Fire, which was supposed to take over the French government and establish fascism there. And he thought that that was a model to emulate in the United States.
And what was Butler's reaction to Jerry Maguire? And
well, Butler, at first, what he heard is he couldn't believe what his ears, and that they would come to him. Who he had the, won the Congressional Medal of Honor twice, and he was a really devout American who would never entertain fascism. So he tried to discover. He knew that if he tried to expose him by himself, that he would be attacked and disbelieved. So he went to the Philadelphia Record and got a highly esteemed journalist, Paul Comedy French, to go talk to the plotters and see what and get validation of what they had said to him. And the plotters were even more frank with Paul Comedy French than they were with Butler. They said that some American people would fall for the idea of saving the Constitution with this army.
Would you define what fascism means for our listeners?
Fascism is the rule by a leader who takes power by force, is not elected, and uses arbitrary means to run a country to benefit usually the wealthy class.
So this plot to seize the White House was brought about by a wealthy class of people, correct?
It was brought by the wealthy and the corporations that they controlled. They were very important people in it. And they had cooperation from Remington Arms, who was going to supply the munitions for the March on Washington, and J.P. Morgan for money, and DuPont for money, the Pew Fund for money. They viewed Roosevelt as a communist, and they wanted to get rid of him, and they thought this was a good way to do it.
So basically, the wealthy were protecting their own interests.
Well, of course, yes.
Yeah.
And they felt that once they were in power, they could run the country. They would just dump democracy and run things their own way.
Could you tell us a little more about the Bonus Army? I know a lot of our listeners are unaware of what they were about.
Came to Washington in 1924, I believe it was, and this was from World War I, and they had been promised a bonus. So they went to Washington to demand that Congress vote them the bonus. And Hoover was the president at that time, and he decided to get rid of them there as nuisances. So he sent MacArthur and also Eisenhower against the Bonus Army, driving them out of Washington. And that really made MacArthur's name poison to the vets, so that he couldn't use him for the plot.
And why is your book important to people today, The Plot to Seize the White House?
Well, it's important because the presence of fascism is always here. The danger... Eisenhower warned the American people about the danger of America military industrial complex. He claimed that they would get together to overthrow democracy. And that was President Eisenhower. And he was right.
Would you describe this current government as the current U.S. government as a fascist government?
You mean our government today?
Yes.
I don't know whether they could get away with anything like that, but they certainly are doing away with our civil liberties, giving permission to invade homes without warrants and so forth.
Yes, indeed. Well, I've called them fascist many a times on the air, so...
What's that? You're talking about?
I've called this current United States government fascist many times on the air and still haven't heard anything from them yet, though. So, what would you most want our listeners to know about your book, about the plot to seize the White House, and...
I would want them to investigate. Right now, it's difficult to get a copy of the plot because it's out of print and it's... selling for a lot of money, but if they can get it from the library perhaps and study it and see what they can do to prevent fascism in the United States.
Are you going to try to get your book republished in any form?
Yes, trying to get it published as a paperback.
I think that would be very good.
It's actually very important because this is a part of American history. And the people need to know this because it's been kept out of the history books.
Yes, it has. I was pretty surprised when I first found out about it, and I first found out about your book, which was only about 4 or 5 years ago. And I immediately went to the library and found it on interlibrary loan, as a friend of mine who introduced me to your book said that it was out of print, and at that time he could only find copies for around $200, and now they're over $300. So
yes.
I've read your book twice, and I'm really amazed by the amount of information you have in there.
Yeah, well, mainly it came from the McCormick-Dixon Committee, which hurt. And the interestingly enough, when Butler first revealed that, the press, including Time Magazine, ridiculed it and made it seem like a ridiculous claim. But when the McCormick-Dixon Committee investigated and found substantiated everything that Papa and Paul Comrie French had to say, you would have thought that they would give that equal space, instead of which there was a six-point mention of it as a footnote in the back of the magazine, and that was it. They never really retracted their ridicule.
So did anything ever happen to the plotters after this investigation?
You would have thought that the plotters would have been arrested for treason.
With the pressure.
Yeah, Roosevelt was in power. He didn't. And the reason is not too clear, but some of the experts seem to think that he had made a deal with the American Liberty League, which folded its tent and stole away. He made it clear that if they would stop attacking his new deal, he would not make an issue out of the plot. And that is probably why nothing happened to them.
The information about the plot was basically put underground and covered up?
No, they didn't cover it up. They ignored it for the most part because it would have been dangerous, furthermore, for them to come out with it and try to implicate these powers in the United States. Would have been very embarrassing for capitalism. Roosevelt was not a communist or a socialist. He was actually a capitalist. And what he was trying to do with the New Deal was to save capitalism, not destroy it. But these dumb bastards thought that he was trying to introduce socialism or communism in the United States. They were totally misinformed, but they were just interested in their own special fortress. They wanted to keep their money. And one of the plotters, who was an heir of the Singer Sewing Machine Company, said that he was willing to spend half his money to defeat the New Deal to save the other half. So it was really a conservationist move on the part of the American Liberty League. The American Liberty League was afraid of exposure, so they folded their tents in South Island and stole away, saying that their purpose had been accomplished and they were no longer necessary. They never said a word about being the plotters.
And can the McCormick-Dickstein Committee's information be found on the Internet, do you know?
I don't know.
Well,
I guess I could look into that.
I think the only way it can be gotten is for the Freedom Act to compel a release of the information.
I seem to recall that J. Edgar Hoover was somehow involved in the investigation. Is that true?
Sorry? No. And he was not involved. But the Attorney General there did nothing about the case. So the case has really been in dormant and unknown to the American public. No, the FBI was not involved.
Is there any other information that you would like our listeners to have about this plot or about your book?
I think that what people should know is that the danger of fascism is always present, and they have to look to measures which would introduce the kind of thing that Hitler and Mussolini did. And they also should know that General Butler was an American hero for having destroyed this outfit. And if it hadn't been for Butler, actually, if he had gone along with the plotter, we would all be raising our hands and saying, ha ha ha, today. So he's a great American hero.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us, Jules. And I really hope that we can get your book reprinted in paperback somewhere, because I believe that this is very important historical information that needs to be known to the public in general. So, you have any last comments before we go?
Nothing, except that I think that we have to remember that American democracy is worth any price to save it and make sure that it doesn't go under to fascism. And to be aware of the constant threat of fascism by people who would benefit financially and in power from it.
Well, I want to thank you for talking with us, Jules, and thank you, Sonny, for helping us out with this interview.
You're welcome.
And
thank you very much, Eugene. I enjoyed the interview, and I hope it does some good.
I think it will. And
word about the plot.
I think it will, and I'll also do my best to try and get more information out there to hopefully get that, to get the plot to seize the White House republished. So thank you very much, Jules.
Thank Cable.
Thank you, and I'll be keeping in touch. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Bye.